curious. Yeah, there was every visit I learned something. Usually it's about physics. This time I learned never to drive to Toronto from Montreal during the winter months. Sorry, I think so. It looks on. I was told it was on. Is it loud? Okay, can we be heard? All right, well, let's go ahead. I'm going to talk today about the radius of neutron stars and its effect on our understanding of the dense matter equation of state. What I want to cover, what I want to impress you with is, first of all, you should know I'm an observational X-ray astronomer. So I do observation. That's my major interest. But we have a lot of truck with nuclear theory. And so to sort of contextualize that, I'm going to describe to you what the impacts are of these sorts of observations on nuclear theory. What I want to convince you of is that we've measured a neutron star radius to 15% accuracy under model-dependent assumptions, meaning we make certain assumptions. They're well-founded in astronomy. They're less transparent to people who are outside of observational astrophysics. But if you have any questions about those, I'm happy to explain them. And I'd also like to convince you by the end of this talk that future observations will measure the mass-radius relationship with neutron stars, and in doing so, determine the dense matter equation of state. So this is actually an important thing to do to determine the dense matter equation of state. And this is sort of a history of how we got to where we are in understanding how the nucleus works. And basically, if you want to talk about how the nucleus works, you have to, you know, you really start in 1932 with the discovery of the neutron. Before that, we're clearly a bunch of protons in a nucleus, but how do they stick together? Coulomb forces should throw them apart. And so suddenly the discovery of the neutron gives you a particle that can help hold it together as long as there's a force between the neutron and the protons in themselves. And that was the discovery of the strong force. For the next 30 years, it was understood that the strong force is non-superpositional and multi-body in nature. In that way, it didn't lend itself to analytic approximation. And so it was parameterized with Skirnin potentials or similar potentials. And that had some success in explaining the properties of very small nuclei with a small number of nucleons, but it's still really bad at calculating things like the total binding energy of anything with even a small handful of nucleons, let alone a couple hundred of them. It was in the 60s with the discovery of quarks and the development of QCD that was able to explain the existence of these larger neutrons, protons, mesons, and hyperons. And when we talk about QCD, usually we talk about QCD at finite energy or temperature. And this does an outstanding job of explaining how quarks interact on one-to-one interactions. But we don't have an exact theoretical apparatus, or rather a practical exact theoretical apparatus, to perform the many-body interaction calculations between nucleons, like neutrons and protons. And so in order to do that, theorists rely on the approximate methods of effective field theories in order to make estimates for what the binding energies are, what the interaction cross-sections are. These do a pretty good phenomenological job, but they're not complete. Today, we don't have an exact theory for calculating all the properties of the nucleus. And it becomes especially relevant when we get to at and above nuclear density, that is, in the nuclei themselves, but also in matter, which is above nuclear density. And that includes everything that is inside, you know, basically 90% of the radius of a neutron star. And that happens at a density of around a few 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter. And it's especially relevant for asymmetric matter when you have many more neutrons and protons, as is expected, for example, in the center of a neutron star. It's important to note that it is technically impossible to create cold nuclear matter above nuclear density in terrestrial laboratories. And cold nuclear matter just means something that's non-relativistic. If you wanted to do that, you would have to take many nuclei and somehow bind them together. Coulomb, you know, forces repulse, and so you're not able to hold them together. And that means that it's really not possible to produce, from a technical standpoint, matter in bulk at and above nuclear density in terrestrial laboratories. There's just no way that we can explore it. And for that reason, we can look to neutron stars. Neutron stars are bound together by the gravitational force, and so it holds together this bulk dense matter, and so we can study this matter in bulk. And therefore, neutron stars are unique sites. They are the only sites in the universe where we can study cold, dense QCD in the universe in precisely the same way that black holes are unique sites for studying strong field gravity. And so if we want to solve dense matter QCD, neutron stars are going to be the astrophysical tool for doing it. They're the only place where this matter exists in the universe. I'd like to, just before I go on, I'd like to point out that this really should be an embarrassment to everybody, the state of this theory. You know, if we were good physicists, we would be able to predict everything that happens to nuclei. We should be able to figure out the interaction cross-sections from bombardment. We should be able to figure out, you know, the fractions by which a excited nucleus will decay into whatever channels. And we can barely do any of that from a phenomenological standpoint, let alone from an ab initio theoretical one. And this is important stuff. This is, you know, everything in this room is made out of these things. And we don't understand, we don't have a good theoretical apparatus for calculating their behavior. We should. And if you think that in 1,000 years we won't, I think you're wrong. But the question is when between now and 1,000 years we're going to figure out how nuclei work and be able to explain that. That's the major question. In the meantime, we do what physicists have always done, and that is observations, and try to give our theorist friends the constraints that they need in order to improve the quality of the theory. But this should be a big embarrassment to all of us, right? We should understand this stuff, and we don't. So the dense matter equation of state is important in the strong force regime. This is matter at and above nuclear density, and it exists in the centers of neutron stars. So something to note is that for every proposed dense matter equation of state, it produces a unique mass-radius relationship for neutron stars. And so here we're seeing a figure originally by Latimer in 2000, but been updated a couple of times. This is the most recent generation of it in, I think, 2011. And here we have the radius of neutron stars varying between 8 and 16 kilometers versus its mass between 0 and 2.5 solar masses. And what you see here are three, you know, basic, what you might call families of neutron stars. We have neutron stars which are largely dominated by protons and neutrons, where as soon as you get to masses above about a half a solar mass, the radius is roughly constant, even though the mass increases. Oops, sorry. Radius is roughly constant, even as the mass increases. And then there are a class of neutron stars where once you get to a certain density, instead of just having pure protons and neutrons, there'll be some sort of mesonic condensate in the center, like kaons. When that happens, you have a phase transition, and that tends to lead to equations of state where the radius decreases dramatically as the mass increases just slightly. And then there's the third family where the cores are made up almost entirely of quarks, and that are these light blue lines here. So these are basically single quark, double quark, triple quark states of in the cores of neutron stars. And they produce these three different families, which are what people generally refer to when they talk about the equations of states of neutron stars. But each of these equations of state, you know, the equation of state being pressure as a function of density, you can use each of them and with them predict what the mass radius relationship is for any of them. Okay? So for any different equation of state that you have, you get a different mass-radius relationship. And each of these equations of state contains different physics, which depends upon, you know, what your assumptions are. So in principle, you can do the backward calculation. If you can measure the mass-radius relationship for neutron stars, you can then work it backwards and get out pressure as a function of density. So that's sort of the goal. Work out pressure as a function of density, and that's the dense matter equation of state. And you can see roughly here, there are, you know, on this approximately 20 viable equations of state. But let me point out to you that all of these use uncertain parameters based on nuclear physics measurements. And so all of these lines have a certain amount of, you know, wiggle room around them. So if you really wanted to, you could really fill in this graph until it was completely black with the viable equations of state that exist now, such as the uncertainty in them. Okay. So, yeah.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first, let me tell you about setting those aside. You can do that, but what you should know is that one of the things that determines whether or not they can be set inside is the symmetry energy, which is how much energy it takes to turn a neutron into a proton. And that's highly uncertain to the level of its sign being uncertain. And if its sign has the wrong sign, then you will get a condensate. So you can set them aside, and there are good observational reasons. Actually, I'm going to argue that we should in a few view graphs. But those who do these calculations tell me that they are getting closer. They're getting closer to be able to explain observations, which I'm sure you're already aware of, make these a little, you know, more than a little dubious. They believe they're going to be able to overcome it. But, you know, you can set aside, if you want to set them aside, yes, it does constrain.
Well, I'm just trying to get a feel for how many, we all have our personal theoretical priors.
Right.
And how much of this statement that you fill in the entire parameter space
right.
is dependent upon those priors.
Yeah. So the important physical parameters, the most important one is the symmetry energy, and that's uncertain at like the 10% level. So I'm going to argue that, though, that we set that aside in a few graphs. I'm sorry, you had a question.
No, I was just wondering something similar. Like you mentioned there are like five families.
Yeah.
I was wondering if some of the families are not already excluded by the observation.
Say that again?
Some of the families are not already excluded by the
observation. Well, there are observations which indicate that, which strongly disfavor certain of the families. So, for example, if you wanted to, you could disfavor the quark families because usually those have associated with them, the quark families, and especially some of the condensate families, because those usually have associated with them high neutrino emissivities, which imply a certain type of cooling, usually accelerated. And so neutron stars, which shouldn't be visible, which shouldn't be hot, are. But there's almost always a mass dependence, so how big the neutron star is, because usually the phase change happens above a certain mass, so the pressure in the center could go above a certain value in order to produce that condensate. And that is very difficult to measure and usually is not measured, so it's difficult to exclude that from an observational standpoint.
Question. Yeah. This has always comes up in us in the gravitational wave camp, or talking
right.
About what they think. And I don't see how you would be able to answer this in the summary, but some people ask where it would be possible. You have more than one equation state tied on the whatever the origin of the what produced the neutron star. Is this something people wonder about?
Okay, there are some in nuclear physics who do think about that, but that is not the most simplest explanation for matter at and above nuclear density.
So the idea is that one measurement would tell a good set of measurements would tell us something about the equation state.
Yes. Yes, if one has a certain measurement of the mass radius relationship, then one has a certain measurement of the equation of state. But it is hypothesized that you could have multiple, but it's not the standard. Okay. Let me skip this because we don't really need to go over that. So how I mentioned that you can measure the equation of state for neutron stars. This is originally pointed out by Lee Lindblom. It was, you know, it's been true for stars for over a century, but Lee Lindblom worked it out for neutron stars and just showed that, you know, dense matter equation state maps to a unique mass radius relationship. And it basically works like this. You have a massive object, it is self-gravitating, and it wants to shrink because that's how gravity works. And so it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. That increases the density in the center until the pressure builds in order to balance the force of gravity. So this is hydrostatic equilibrium. So once you get to a high enough pressure in the center, it just balances the force of gravity, and that sets a certain radius. Okay? So if you have some mass, that sets the strength of gravity pulling inwards. The pressure at the center, which balances the strength of gravity, is set by the density, and that's set by the size. And so knowing this equation of state, pressure as a function of density, produces a unique mass as a function of radius relationship. And so measuring the mass as a function of radius gives you the dense matter equation of state. So that's our goal, is to measure the mass-radius relationship and so derive the dense matter equation of state. Yeah.
Yeah. That's got to only be true for variables, right? So if you had a confounding parameter, like very strong partition strength magnetic fields or some other...
Oh, well, sure, yeah. If there's other sources of pressure, then that will change what you will see. Absolutely. So what has been done till now? Well, really the best constraints on the mass-radius relationship have come from observations of binary neutron stars, binary pulsars, where you have two pulsars which are spinning. They make pretty good clocks in that way. And in that way, you can measure every aspect of the system, their individual masses being the important one. And so measuring those masses, that can be done to extremely high precision, in some cases to 10 to the minus 4%. And that's valuable because those masses of the neutron stars work as a lower limit to the upper limit of the mass of the neutron stars. And you'll just to point that out here, when we look back at this relationship, you can see that each of the mass radius relationships eventually terminate at some mass, and that's because they become unstable. Basically, the speed of sound is larger than the speed of light. They're viable to collapse at that point. So that tells you that each of the equations of states predicts a maximum mass for a neutron star. And so measuring the mass of a neutron star sets a lower limit to what that upper limit can be. And so the goal for radio pulsar measures, radio pulsar observers, has been to measure ever-increasing masses. And so any method they can employ to measure higher and higher masses is what they look to. So that's been great. And there have been results recently that have made new constraints, and those have been valuable. But these kinds of systems are not actually useful at the present time for measuring the radii of neutron stars. Everything that is observed from these types of neutron stars tends to happen out here in the magnetosphere. Maybe there's some thermal emission coming from the poles, but in general, it's not observable, and we're not able to make measurements of radii using these. So we only get masses out of these types of systems. The types of systems that we really want to observe in order to measure their radii look a little something like this. And that's it. This is a great system for measuring the radius of a neutron star. It has a radius, it's quiet, it's not variable, it's emitting isotropically, all the sorts of properties that one wants when what you're going to have is a point source, really, in order to measure the radius of a neutron star. And there's a class of such systems where that can be done, which we've been focusing on, and those systems are known as quiescent low-mass X-ray binaries. There are probably a dozen different classes of neutron stars. This is one of them. So if you're not terribly familiar with the class of quiescent low-mass X-ray binaries, that's not surprising. There's lots of them, lots of classes. But let me tell you a little bit about these systems. Absolutely, yeah. So that's something that you can do. However, the constraints, yeah. So what's going on there? This graph gives me trouble. Hold on. Let me show you that here. So that's here on this Latimer graph. So, right. So if you have a neutron star, it has some mass. If it's spinning fast enough, eventually the surface will be spinning at the Keplerian speed, assuming some radius. And the Keplerian speed begins to shed, so we'll start losing mass. So if it ever goes above the Keplerian speed of the surface, it will be equal to the Keplerian speed of the surface at some point, okay, at least when it begins shedding mass. And so that produces constraints which look like this for pulsars that have been observed. And these sorts of objects tell you that the equation of state for neutron stars must come above this line. That's the sort of constraint that you end up with. Okay. But that's another reason why measuring faster and faster pulsars is an interesting thing to do, why people look for faster and faster pulsars. If you were to, for example, detect a sub-millisecond pulsar, that would be an enormous theoretical constraint on the dense matter equation of state. So there are observational limits, and the problem is that all of the systems that are observed have evolutionary effects, which determine what their spin periods are, many of them have observational selection effects, which means that if they weren't, that makes them difficult to observe. So, for example, probably the most reliable distribution of millisecond pulsar periods comes from the observation of I think it's 23 pulsars now in 47 Tuck. Which have been spun up into the millisecond range. That gives you a distribution of pulsars. There are none below a millisecond. I think the fastest one is like 1.7 milliseconds, it might be, in 47 Tuck itself, but there's faster ones elsewhere. So that's sort of the observational limit. There's no, if there were faster ones, that were just slightly faster, they should be detectable. But there are observational reasons why it's a little tougher to observe faster ones in the radio band. There are searches for X-ray pulsars that are faster. Those have not been successful.
Speaking of rotation, don't all these mass radius calculations assume just hydrostatic equilibrium?
Yes.
So shouldn't rotation be considered?
Yes.
When they're calculating the mass radius rotation?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Do you know but, how much it would change the mass radius?
It's not negligible, but it's not considered. And probably the main reason it's not considered is that until we have radii that are measured at such a level where people begin to question the interpretation of it, it's not something that people are likely to do. And this is not because, no, actually it is exactly because people are lazy. Yeah, so it's okay. But it hasn't been done.
If you want to.
Yeah. But yeah, it hasn't been done. But it does, you know, at the spin periods that are expecting these systems, you're like at half the Keplerian period. So it should be important. Yeah.
So slightly off topic, but to say I put the radio a little bit outside, you're saying that the observations are kind of homing in to the most massive stars. But if I also want to ask or find out what the answer to the question is, what are the lowest masses that we know of bona fide neutron stars? Where is the bound?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I don't know what the uncertainty is on the lowest measured mass neutron star is, but I think it's about 1.3 solar masses, but I don't remember what the uncertainty is. I think it's about 0.05, but again, I'm not positive about that. It's interesting because there are theoretical reasons. So people who simulate supernovae say that you really can't produce a neutron star with a mass below like half a solar mass. So
huge gap between the 0.5 to 1.3.
Mm-hmm. Potentially, yeah, but there aren't that many of them measured that way, and there.
But that's an observational selection.
Just to give you an example of how observational selection effects have appeared, keep in mind that all the binary radio pulsars that have observed, where you have two neutron stars around each other, all end up having masses that are within about a few percent of 1.4 solar masses. But nobody believes that all neutron stars have 1.4 solar masses. But there they are. And so that implies that there's some evolutionary effect that leaves them there at 1.4 solar masses. And they, you know, their systems that produce them are almost always binary massive stars that go supernova. So they have similar evolutionary histories. But there are different types of binaries that should have different evolutionary histories and which will have different mass neutron stars. In fact, I'll talk about that in a minute. Let me move forward here. So we want to observe quiescent low-mass X-ray binaries, and we are doing that. And what's interesting about these systems is, first of all, as low-mass X-ray binaries, they're thought to have magnetic fields that are below about 10 to the 10 maximum, but probably closer to 10 to the 9 or below 10 to the 8 Gausses. And that's at the surface. And that's useful because that means it can be neglected for radiative transfer, which is going to be important for our radiative transfer later on. What we have in a quiescent low-mass X-ray binary is that there is a companion star, which is evolved off the main sequence, and it is constantly feeding an accretion disk. And this accretion disk tends to be only slight. So in these particular systems, the mass accretion rate from the companion star is very low. So the accretion disk tends to be optically thin most of the time. And as such, it cools very efficiently, which means that it is always unionized. And you have unionized matter in the accretion disk. But the disk will fill up as matter continues to pour into it from the companion star, eventually becomes optically thick. When it does so, a thermal instability will occur that will ionize the accretion disk. And in doing so, the optical depth goes way up, which means that it will ionize the entire accretion disk. It can then hold a magnetic field, which is then a source of viscosity that drives matter down onto the surface of the neutron star and produces an X-ray outburst. This is an example of one such system. This is the classical dwarf novus scenario, by the way. But it works for neutron stars too. This is an example of one such system, one of the most prolific ones that we know of, called Aquila X1. And there are periods where we see outbursts that last about 30 days, with interspersed with periods of quiescence, which are on the order of 6 months or so. So the outbursts, the peak luminosities are typically on the order of about a tenth of Eddington. When it's observed in quiescence, they're down. They're detected at about 10 to 33 ergs per second or so. So 100,000th of Eddington or so. So what we believe we're seeing when we are in X-ray quiescence is just the bare neutron star itself. And I'll tell you why that's the case in a few slides. But before we do that, let me...
Is the emission isotropic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Let me tell you about that in a few few graphs about why we expect the emission to be isotropic. Okay. This doesn't like that. So just to make sure that we're all on the same page, when I'm talking about different parts of the neutron star, we have the core of the neutron star, which is where the matter is entirely supernuclear density matter. That dominates the radius. Typically, on the order of about 90% of the radius of the neutron star is matter at and above nuclear density. Above that, we have the crust of the neutron star, which we'll talk about. That's going to be where the energy is produced that we observe. And at the very top of the neutron star, we have the atmosphere of the neutron star. That is where the radiative transfer occurs that produces the emergent spectrum that we see from the neutron star. So those are the three important areas of the neutron star that we're going to discuss: the atmosphere, the crust, and the core of the neutron star.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Very naive question.
When you that's fine. Yeah.
State,
yeah. That's correct. Yeah, we're only interested in the equation of state of matter at and above nuclear density. Once you get below nuclear density, there are very good theoretical, there are very good observational and theoretical constraints of the way the matter works. And once you get below about 10 to the 14. Yes. Say that again.
Like superfluid phases in the atmosphere.
Well, the superfluidity in neutron stars doesn't really occur in the atmosphere. You have to get to densities below, like above, like 10 to the 10 gap, 10 to the 10 grams per cubic centimeter or so, and that's sort of like in the inner part of the crust, where it's thought that there are a lot of superfluid neutrons below the superneutron, below the neutron drip line. So that's about, up to a couple hundred meters deep. So the atmosphere is maybe like half a centimeter, the crust goes down a couple hundred meters, and then the core is 90% of the radius, canonically.
Convection.
Say that again?
Atmosphere is basically convection.
I don't understand the question.
What process heats the atmosphere is convection?
No, it's stable. So it's really just conductivity and radiative transfer. So photon opacity. So, what do we see when we see neutron stars? So first of all, let's just assume for now, so I'll talk about this in a moment, that the heat is coming from beneath the atmosphere of the neutron star. When accretion stops in these systems, when it shuts off and the disk is cold, everything that's heavier than hydrogen settles out in gravity. So helium, it's basically like rocks and water, and that leaves you with a photosphere which is composed of pure hydrogen. That's great because a pure hydrogen photosphere is the easiest thing to model atmospherically. That's what we do. And there have been a number of groups that have modeled the atmospheres of neutron stars, basically starting with Slava Zavlin, 1996, and Roger Kapalan Romani, although George Pavlov tells me that Russian school children were doing this on envelopes in the 1970s, which may be true, I don't know. But in any case, this has been done by several groups since then. The comparisons between the different calculations all work up to within the uncertainty of the calculations, which is at the level of about a few percent across the band. So there's a lot of consistency between the predicted hydrogen atmosphere spectra. And just to tell you what they're like, they're very similar to black body spectra in shape, but they look different at the same effective temperature. And the reason they look different is because the dominant opacity in an ionized hydrogen atmosphere is just free scattering, which scales to the photon energy to the minus third power. Compare that to the black body assumption, which is that the photon emissivity is energy independent. And so that gives you a slightly different looking spectrum for the same effective temperature. So here we have green lines of hydrogen atmospheres and red lines of black bodies with the same effective temperature. So here's 10 to the 6.2 Kelvin, 10 to the 5.6 Kelvin, 10 to the 5.0 Kelvin. And what you notice is that more of the energy comes out at higher photon energies for hydrogen atmosphere spectra. And that's because at higher photon energy, the opacity is lower, which means that you can see deeper into the atmosphere where you have a higher temperature, where you have higher temperature material. And so you see that higher temperature material. And that produces a spectrum which is larger. Consider that if you were to interpret a hydrogen atmosphere spectrum as a black body spectrum, you would take something which looks like this. You would move the peak up here, which means that you would misinterpret the temperature as being too high. And that would require you to decrease the normalization of that spectrum, which means that you would misinterpret the radius of the neutron stars being too low, right? So the atmospheric modeling is important. when, you know, it's easy to show that you get, you end up with orders of magnitude discrepancies between what you would measure in a black body spectrum compared to a hydrogen atmosphere spectrum. So the fact that it's a hydrogen atmosphere neutron star and us knowing that is important for interpreting the spectra themselves. Let me point out to you that when we do these observations, what we measure isn't the radius of the neutron star generally. It's what's referred to as the radiation radius of the neutron star. So the way this is done is you measure the effective temperature by finding where the peak is. That tells you the temperature. And then the luminosity is just that effective temperature to the fourth power. And I'm just speaking heuristically now. It's obviously, we do spectral fitting for this, but think of it as a black body for now. But just take the effective temperature to the fourth power. That's the amount of luminosity per unit area. And the total luminosity is going to be equal to the, is going to include the radius of the neutron star. So you take the radius squared. That gives you the luminosity. You actually measure the flux of the neutron star, and that means that you also need to know the distance to the neutron star. So that's an important uncertainty in the observations. Okay. But as I said, what we're measuring here isn't actually the radius of the neutron star. It's what's called the radiation radius. And that's because when you look at a neutron star, you're actually, there's gravitational light bending near the edges. So you're looking around the back of the neutron star, which, if you know what you're actually looking at, is it looks like it subtends a larger angle on the sky. Okay. But it's actually a simple factor of the redshift factor larger on the sky. And so the relationship between the radiation radius and the physical radius of the neutron star is just the redshift factor. But it's important to note that this redshift factor has the mass of the neutron star in it too. Okay? We can't measure the masses of these neutron stars. So when we make this measurement of the radiation radius, what we actually have is a relationship between the physical mass and the physical radius of the neutron star. Okay?
So that.
So you would hope so. And so did I when I was a younger man. But it turns out that when you have a low mass X-ray binary, the companion star is a low mass star. It's less than like a solar mass, and that means that the uncertainties on it are going to be a substantial fraction of the. So the uncertainty, it ends up with a 30% uncertainty basically for the best systems that we have in the mass, and that's not small enough. We need something closer to 5% uncertainty in the mass, and that's because there aren't good absorption lines in the photosphere. It's just not. We just can't do it. It doesn't move it enough. It's a low mass companion compared to a more massive neutron star. So one would hope so. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you know the rotation periods of
quiescence? Very often they're measured in the in quiescence because you can see ellipsoidal variations. And they, for example, Aquilex 1, it's like 18 hours. They tend to be between about 6 hours and 24 hours.
The ellipsoidal variations, that's the orbital period.
That's correct.
Oh,
for most of them, no. In the cases where we do, it's because when they are in outburst, we observe pulsations during type 1 X-ray bursts. Aquilex 1 is, again, one example where we do know that period. That's around 580 hertz, I think it is. Okay.
So that's fairly fast.
Yes. That's correct. Yes.
So then, you worry then about rotation of the spectral fitting because it will make half the star look bluer and half the star look dimmer, and that breakup would be a 30% effect.
So worry is not the way that I would put it. It's something that's neglected at present. So let me. Could you hold that to the end? Because I think I'll be revealing things that will satisfy you. Okay. So that's the spectrum of the neutron star. But then there's the luminosity of the neutron star. And what produces the luminosity of the neutron star is important because it tells us why we should expect isotropy from the surface. And so what happens is this: there's a process known as deep crustal heating. The way that deep crustal heating works is that you have accretion onto the surface of the neutron star. So you have matter dropping down here from the top of the neutron star. And what that does is that presses everything in the crust down to a deeper level. So the crust, if you think of the crust starting at the very top, being composed of the ashes of whatever burns in the atmosphere due to type 1 X-ray bursts, for example, those nuclei, if you force them down to greater depth, you will force electron captures onto those nuclei. Okay? So for example, if you start with iron at the top of the crust at a density of around 10 to the 9 grams per cubic centimeter, you will force it to become chromium-56 through electron captures. And that will deposit about 0.01 MeV for every proton that you add at the top of the neutron star. Right? Further down, you'll have chromium-56 become titanium-56 through electron captures, and that will add another 0.01 MeV per proton added to the surface. And so on and so on and so on through a chain of reactions that occur all the way down to nuclear density. And if you add up the energy from all of these different reactions, you end up with about 1.5 MeV per accreted proton at the surface of the neutron star. Now, that's not that much energy. Compare that to 20% of the rest mass that gets deposited in kinetic energy when the proton hits the surface. But the important difference here is that this energy is happening in the crust where it's in close thermal contact with the core. So what that means is that if you start with a cold core, you have an outburst where you're adding matter to the surface. It heats up the crust. That heat sees the cold core and it goes into it, heating up the core slightly. And then the outburst stops. The hot core drives the thermal luminosity from the surface of the neutron star, and it cools. But then another outburst occurs, and that'll heat up the core more. And another outburst occurs, and that'll heat up the core more, and more, and more, and more, and more. And the core will keep heating up until it reaches a temperature in the center of the neutron star such that during the quiescent period, it drives out a luminosity equal to the amount of energy that's deposited in the crust during the outburst period due to deep crustal heating. So there's an equilibrium that happens, and that equilibrium luminosity can be predicted based on the time average mass accretion rate at the surface, which is an observable. And those two seem to work out pretty well. It's worth pointing out, though, that this is sort of the standard chain of reactions if you start with iron-56, but it depends a lot on what your mass model is for these nuclei, and there are a lot of uncertainties in these reactions. For example, here we have a picnonuclear reaction where neon produced calcium-72. It results in a substantial deposit of energy, about 0.28 MeV at a density of 10 to the 12 grams per cubic centimeter. But the time scale for this reaction is uncertain by about 10 orders of magnitude. It could take a few milliseconds. It could take thousands of years. And that may be enough time, for example, for this neon to be shoved down to, or excuse me, this magnesium to be shoved down to a greater depth, and some other reaction to take place. But what isn't uncertain is that if you start with ashes at the top, you can figure out what the amount of binding energy per nucleon is for that mixture of ashes, and you can take cold, dense nuclear matter at the bottom of the crust and figure out what the binding energy is or the total energy per nucleon there. And that difference is going to be the energy difference between the top of the crust and the bottom of the crust per proton that's accreted. And that, depending on your mass model, results in predicted deposited heat between 1 and 2 MeV per accreted proton.
Would this then imply that the outbursts should be periodic?
No. The outbursts are quasi-periodic, because what they are the disk filling up with energy, with matter, becoming thermally unstable, emptying, and then once they're empty, they're cold again. And the time scale for them being filled up is set by the accretion time scale from the companion star, which is due to either gravitational radiation or nuclear evolution. So they're quasi-periodic, or thought to be. One of the nice things that results from this is that let me spend just a little time on this, is that it predicts where the heat should be deposited in the crust, and in principle that predicts a thermal light curve for what you should see from the surface of the neutron star after an outburst occurs. So this is just a quick calculation that we did. If you were to deposit matter on the surface of a neutron star at Eddington for a day, wouldn't that be swell? So what we have here is, so this is the density. Oops. So this is the density into the neutron star crust, starting at 10 to the 8, down to the 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter. This is time after the outburst begins. Okay? And this is the temperature in the crust. Okay? So you see here the temperature profile before the outburst begins. And so the outburst begins, matter is deposited at the top, and then deep crustal heating occurs, and you can see that the different reactions at different depths deposit energy at those different depths, and that sends the temperature at those different depths higher. Here's that neon-neon reaction I referred to earlier. Okay? And then if you were to shut off all of the mass accretion at once, that heat finds its way to the surface. A lot of it finds its way into the center as well, but some of it finds its way to the surface, and you would then see a light curve of decay over time from the surface. That's very valuable because it means that this could be used as a probe to understand thermal conductivity through the crust. And in fact, that has occurred It hasn't been on systems which go into outbursts for one day. It tends to be done on systems which go into outbursts for very long periods of time. And that's what that allows it to do is that the heat that's depositing the crust is so great that the crust becomes out of thermal equilibrium with the core. So the cooling that you see is dominated by the high temperature of the core until the core, the temperature of the crust is out of thermal equilibrium with the core. So the cooling that you see is due to the high heat capacity of the crust. You see the luminosity due to the decay in the temperature of the crust. So here we have a system which had a 13-year outburst. It heated up over that 13 years. The crust is well out of thermal equilibrium with the core. And after it shut off, it was predicted to have a thermal light curve which lasted like this. It would take on the order of 10 years for it to fully cool back to thermal equilibrium with the core. And that is being observed in this system, as well as a couple of other systems where this sort of decay has observed. And so this is valuable because it explores the nuclear physics of the crust, but also it supports the deep crustal heating model as the model which produces this luminosity. And because of that, the luminosity that we see is due to a hot core of the neutron star, which means that it is isothermal, and it should come out in all directions, which leads to the isotropy assumption. Okay?
You're assuming that the neutron star doesn't have a magnetic field?
We are assuming no magnetic field. That's correct. And it's only important, so if you want to have the magnetic field play an important role, it would tend to need to be on the order of 10 to the 12 Gauss or so. There's no evidence for magnetic fields of that strength in these systems. There certainly are in other systems, but not in these systems. That has not been, there have been no outbursts that have been, not even in persistent sources, is it thought to melt the crust. So I think the answer is not in the sources that we see, which is not to say no. Okay. So that's deep crustal heating. That is the luminosity prediction. So this is how we measure the radius of a neutron star. First of all, we have to discover the objects, which is what we do in looking for new bison LMS X-ray binaries. We observe their thermal X-ray spectrum. We measure their effective temperature. We measure their bolometric flux from the spectrum. We have to know their distance. Radiation radius uncertainty is as uncertain as our distance uncertainty, and that's an important uncertainty, as you can see. And with that, we can produce the radius measurement.
How do you measure the distance?
So measuring the distance is really hard. And so if you do it to sources in the field, those are typically uncertain by about 50% because it's done by looking at the companion star and spectral typing it and then expecting that you know what its radius is and therefore its luminosity. So those are uncertain by 50%. But as I'll discuss in a moment, the better systems to use are ones that are in globular clusters where the distances are considerably more certain. Yeah. That's correct. But if the spectral modeling means anything, the two are exactly precisely, yeah, absolutely. If we were able to observe down in the UV, then that would not be the issue, but yes.
So the fact that we don't know the mass of these neutron stars, I was looking at this recent measurement of mass by Antoniadis, this two solar mass.
Yeah.
And it has a companion, which is a white dwarf.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying that just by looking at the hydrogen belt of the white dwarf,
mm-hmm.
they could infer the mass.
Yes.
So can the same thing be done if these have hydrogen belts? Can they infer the mass?
It can't because the companions to these are not white dwarfs.
Not from the companions.
Right, but in order to measure the mass of the neutron star, you have to know the mass of the white dwarf very precisely. And they only do that through a spectral model.
Yeah, so when they measure the mass of the white dwarf, they just do it directly. So
yes, they have a spectrum and they have a model for what that spectrum implies in terms of the mass of the white dwarf.
Exactly, so why can't we do that, the same thing with these neutron stars?
Because these neutron stars, their companions are not white dwarfs. Their companions are post-main sequence stars.
No, I'm saying the same thing they did to measure the mass of the white dwarf.
Yeah. So here's how that works. Yeah.
You need that in order to get that. I mean, you need to have a good stellar model for the object.
Right.
And if you don't have that,
no.
Then we wouldn't be hearing this talk right now.
Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah. That doesn't exist for main sequence stars or post main sequence stars. It does exist for white dwarfs.
Okay. And also something I didn't understand there was they were saying that above a certain mass, these stars lose their hydrogen belt.
You mean for white dwarfs? Yes.
Does it apply to neutron stars?
No. 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 Yeah. It's different. That's sort of, that's really, it's, that, that is a, it's, they're evolutionarily different. So the observations that I'm talking about have been done with the two operating X-ray observatories, which have their various strengths. One of them is the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which was launched by NASA 15 years ago. Its strength is that it has very high spatial resolution. That's useful if you're looking into crowded fields of X-ray sources. XMM Newton is the European Space Agency launched X-ray observatory. It has poor spatial resolution, which means that it's less useful for looking in crowded X-ray fields. But it has four times the collecting area, and that's really what you need if you want to look at a point source. But these two capabilities are going to be important. Something that you should know about X-ray observations, if you don't, is that they are the absolutely easiest things to analyze in the world, because what you get when you look at an, a particular X-ray source is you get a list of photons, and the photons have attached to them a time that they were observed, the energy that they had with a uncertainty of about 10%, and with and a position on the sky that the photon came from. So basically, you know everything that there is to know about the photon except for polarization, and that is coming in the future. All right? So, you know, if you can analyze a list of photons, you can do it. This is what the very first quiescent LMS X-ray binary observed with this this instrumentation looked like. It's a Quill X1 again. And what we have here is the photon energy. This is the spectral density, so the amount of photon energy per photon energy range. And what we have here is the crosses are the observed spectrum. This solid line is needed to account for high energy photons, which are not predicted by the thermal spectrum. And the thermal spectrum is this solid line here. That is the expected emitted spectrum from the neutron star fit to the data. And you'll notice that there's a difference between the emitted spectrum and the data that are observed. That difference is due to absorption between us, the observers, and the neutron star. But we can model that exactly. We know exactly what that absorption is due to. You can see that the amount of absorption decreases about exponentially as you increase in photon energy. So we can measure that amount of absorption. That's what we do. But in that first observation, it led to a radiation radius, which was uncertain at, you know, at the 40% level, 13 plus 5 minus 4 kilometers, with an effective temperature of about 135 electron volts. And this parameter parameterizes the amount of absorption, about 35 times 10 to the 20 hydrogen atoms per square centimeter. So that's what the spectrum looks like. Something I'll point out to you again is that this is what we expect to see from the neutron star. That's the predicted hydrogen atmosphere spectrum that you saw the calculations for earlier. This is not. This is a high energy power law which appears to occur in some systems in the field. We don't know what it's due to, but it is there in some systems in the field. But it's not part of the hydrogen atmosphere spectrum. It is a systematic uncertainty. There are proposed explanations for it, but we don't know what it's due to. And a better model for that would be helpful to us. So that's something we think about a lot. In this case, it's about 15% of the total flux in the X-ray band. New star could potentially constrain it in the brightest sources like this one. But yeah, it's not the first thing I would do in new star.
Okay.
It's definitely not the first thing they're doing. So as I said, this is the radiation radius that we fit, and that is made uncertain by the distance, which to this particular star, it's in the field, so that distance is uncertain by 50%. So having a 50% uncertainty to be added to this statistical uncertainty doesn't really get us very far in constraining the dense matter equation of state. So we need to do better in our distance uncertainties, and that's why we go to globular clusters. Globular clusters overproduce low mass X-ray binaries relative to the field per star by about a factor of 1,000. And many of them have accurate distances measured, and those distance measurements are just going to get better now that Gaia has been launched. The distances to globular clusters are relatively small such that we can neglect them for the kinds of analyses that we do. And so what we do is we observe globular clusters, we can identify the quiescent LMS X-ray binary by their soft X-ray spectrum, and then we perform this hydrogen atmosphere analysis to them. Now notice here that there's a little bit, not even a little bit, there is exactly a, it has the properties that we expect from the system, and therefore we assume it's the system. Right? There are, so we've done detailed analyses comparing these sources in the globular clusters to other types of X-ray sources known to come from globular clusters, like millisecond pulsars, coronally active sources, CVs, and they don't have the same spectrum at all. So they're inconsistent with those other populations. Okay. But what has to be done in order to truly confirm them is search for the binary counterpart, measure an orbital period, and show that they exist. And that's occurred in two systems that have been observed in globular clusters, two QMXBs identified this way. So it seems to be a robust method, but it needs to be more of it needs to be done. This is an example of the first QMXB that was observed this way in a globular cluster. What you're looking at here is actually an infrared image. If you want to look at the X-ray image, it's basically these three green circles. That's the X-ray image. The quiescent low mass X-ray binary is out here in the very edge of Omega Sen. The X-ray source is consistent with a hydrogen atmosphere quiescent low mass X-ray binary at the distance of the globular cluster, but it was not consistent with any of the other possible X-ray sources that are known to exist in globular clusters. Okay. So the optical counterpart has been identified, and the orbital period has been measured for the system. So it's clearly a low mass X-ray binary of the type that we expect.
What's the primary difficulty?
The primary difficulty is justifying it to the HST team. And until this last year, which you'll see in a few moments, it wasn't really a compelling argument, but now it is, and you'll see why in a few minutes. This is what the spectrum of that source looked like. So first of all, it's entirely thermal. There's very little absorption. The system was observed because there's very little absorption. There's also the absence of a strong power law component that tends to be true of the systems that we see in globular clusters. There's no hard component. That could be an observational selection effect because, remember, these sources are identified based on their spectrum. So if they had a strong power law component, we wouldn't have detected them that way. That's a big contrast to the field sources, which are identified because they went into outbursts in history sometime. So they were known to be transient systems based on their historical outburst system. But it had the radiation radius about what we expect for a quiescent low mass X-ray binary with a small amount of absorption. All right. So these types of sources have now been discovered. There are about, depending on how you count, five very bright, very useful ones in globular clusters. And we've been analyzing them one by one. And as that has gone on, it was a very interesting observation came to the fore. And that is the measurement in two cases of massive neutron stars. So here we have, again, the mass radius relationship for neutron stars from Latimer. And these two green lines represent the masses measured with uncertainties on the order of about 2%. So you know the width of these lines show you the uncertainty in the masses measured for those neutron stars. These are two radio pulsars where the masses have been measured, both with white dwarf companions. What you immediately see is that masses this high in neutron stars appear to exclude the types of equations of state which have phase transitions in them. So the phase transitions don't really get up that high, and that disfavors those equations of state. Some quark models, if you strain them, can get up to masses that are two solar masses or so, but it disfavors them slightly as well. This equations of state which appear to be favored are the equations of state which are composed of protons and neutrons exclusively. Yeah. So there have been no publications of that as yet. All of the people who do these sorts of calculations who I talked to in the last couple of years are working on it, and they all say, oh, we'll be able to do it.
Okay.
So we're waiting for the results. This is their sort of default standard model. This observation would require them to change some of the parameters in their model. That is what they claim. In the meantime, we'd like to do some things. So we'd like to keep busy. We noticed that this observation sort of favors these equations of state where protons and neutrons dominate. And they have this interesting property, which I'm sure doesn't escape your attention, and that is that the radii are roughly constant over a large range in mass at astrophysically interesting values. So basically above half a solar mass, the radii are what we call quasi-constant. And so that means that it implies that if that's true, if these are the favored equations of state, it implies that the neutron star should all have about the same radius to within about 5%, 10% over the masses that they achieve. So that's great. So we decided that something that we would try is assume that all the neutron stars that we've observed in globular clusters, where the distances are relatively well known, do all have the same radius. And then to do a joint analysis of all of those neutron stars and derive what the implied radius is in that case. So that's what we did. We chose sources that had been observed with XMM. These are the five sources that ended up being our data analysis stream. We excluded a bunch of other sources which are either faint or confused by a nearby source, so we don't get high signal to noise from XMM data because it's been observed with Chandra. But these are the sources that we ended up using for this analysis.
Was the radius measurement you showed in the previous plot the one you calculated?
No. No. That's just to demonstrate how constant, for example, this equation of state is in radius. It's just a line for reference. And I would not call this an equation of state. It's just a constant radius, which is our assumption. I would not claim that that is an equation. It could be an equation of state, but our assumption is we're just measuring constant radius.
I guess each radius measurement that you have would give a curve on this plot, right? Because of the mass uncertainty.
So you're talking about what our observations previously would place a constraint on. Let me show you that. You can barely see it here. But do you see this very faint dotted line here? No. How about this one? So roughly, right about here, so constant. This is a line of constant radiation radius. Okay. So depending on what the radiation radii tend to cover a swath that's like this. And it's consistent with the equation of state that we have here. But you should note that one of the reasons that we selected the targets is because they produce radii which are consistent with what are expected from a theoretical standpoint. So there's some caution to be had there, right? But that's how we build up an observational case, right? So those are the systems that we observed. And so what I, with my graduate student Sebastian, did is we assumed that all the X-ray binaries that we're observing have the exact same radius. And we call this a quasi-constant radius, quasi in the sense that as long as the radii are or as long as the uncertainty in the measured radius that we get out is greater than how much the radius changes over the astrophysically interesting mass range, then the assumption is reasonable within the analysis. Okay. So we do that. We performed a Markov chain Monte Carlo in order to include all the known uncertainties, and we use conservative assumptions so that the uncertainty in the derived radius is something that could be statistically relied upon by our nuclear physics colleagues, because it's important that way. So we included the uncertainty in the distances to each of them. We included the uncertainty in every single observational parameter in each of them. So the error bars that we put on our radius are the largest error bars that we can put on our radius in a viable analysis. Just so you know what the data looks like, this is what our data looks like. These are the five X-ray spectrum for the five different quiescent low mass X-ray binaries. Fit with the five different hydrogen atmosphere models that are fit to them with their different amounts of absorption, their different distances, their different temperatures. And it does a very good job at fitting all of the data simultaneously with a reasonable scatter on the error bars that exist. But these are all the thermal X-ray spectra for these sources. So what we do is we put in an assumption. We're doing an MCMC, so you put in a mass radius for each of these individual objects. You see how consistent it is with the data. You get out a chi-square. That tells you whether or not you should accept that step or you should move back to the previous step and take a different step. And we do that several million times. And that produces a resulting error region for the masses and radii for each of those individual neutron stars. And this is what those look like. So here we have the five quiescent low mass X-ray binaries in the globular clusters M28, NGC-6397, M13, NGC-6304, and Omega-Sen. For each point in radius on this graph, there's a point in radius on this graph, and on this graph, and on this graph, and this graph, because they are assumed to have all the same radius. But what results from this is a distribution in masses for each of these individual sources as well. But if we then take the density of accepted steps and produce a histogram of them, this is what we get as our probability density for the radius of the neutron star. And what we measure from that is the most likely radius for the neutron star, which works out to be about 9.1 kilometers with an uncertainty of on the order of about 15% at 90% confidence. Yeah? No, you're fine. Okay.
But also you have some of the masses would be one sort of mass?
Say that again? Yeah? That is what the data say.
One mass.
So there's a lot of discussion about how much you should interpret, how much people want to interpret this. Oh, does this imply a measurement of a low solar mass? Does this imply a measurement of a high solar mass neutron star? And that is what the data implies. We then point out that there are also here uncertainties in the absorption. There are uncertainties in the distances. And we expect all of these to change if, for example, we get better measurements of absorption, higher signal-to-noise to data. It could be that they collapse around a point down here or a point up here. But these are these do show the probability densities based on the MCMC.
The radius is almost constant, like 9 kilometers or so, but the mass is allowed to change?
Yes, that's exactly. Could you say that again?
I mean, the relation mass radius is not important. I mean, you cannot identify one to one.
I don't understand.
I'm thinking that if you give me the radius, I can tell you the mass.
So the way this works. No, what this is that if you we assume the radius is the same for all of them, and then that picks a different mass for each of them.
Okay.
Right. So that's what the derived spectrum looks like, and this is what the constraint on the equation of state looks like. So this is the best fit radius, 9.1 plus 1.3 minus 1.4 kilometers at 90% confidence, and it disfavors the most popular equations of state for proton-neutron dominant equations of state. It prefers ones that are further down here. And this is actually causing a bit of concern among our nuclear physics colleagues. This is not what they first assume, but they're interested in it because, the assumptions behind the analysis they're all familiar with, and they understand the error bars very well. So this is something that they're working with at the present time. But it has implications, and they're working that out now. That's the measured radius.
You mentioned the number of systematics that could move that around. Have you investigated how much they move?
Yeah, we have. And all of those are described in detail in the paper. I would refer you to those. And it's not an insignificant amount. Okay. So that's the radius of the neutron star. I'm going way over, so let me cut to the quick about what we're going to do in the future. So recall that if you have a black body spectrum, if you put it on the surface of the neutron star, you redshift it, you can't measure the magnitude of that redshift of the black body spectrum. Okay? You have a black body spectrum, you redshift it, it looks like a black body spectrum just at a different temperature. So measuring it, it just looks like it has a different temperature. So you can't measure the redshift if you have a black body spectrum. They look identical. Okay? However, if you have a hydrogen atmosphere spectrum, the reason that occurs is because the emissivity of a black body spectrum is photon energy independent. If you have a hydrogen atmosphere spectrum, the free opacity breaks that degeneracy. The opacity is photon energy dependent. It scales as the photon energy minus third power. And so if you redshift the spectrum, it looks different from the surface of a neutron star than it does if it's unredshifted. And the simple way to think of this is that if you look at a redshifted hydrogen atmosphere spectrum from the surface of a neutron star, you can measure where the peak is. That tells you what the effective temperature is. And that predicts what the curvature at the peak should be. But it will be different because of the redshift. So if you measure the difference between the observed curvature and the theoretical curvature, that tells you the magnitude of the redshift at the surface of the neutron star. So using the same approach, you can still measure the redshift at the surface as well as the radiation radius at the surface. So the radiation radius is what gives us the normalization of the spectrum. You get the peak of the spectrum from temperature is measured at infinity. And then the redshift comes from a measurement of the second derivative at the peak of the spectrum. And that's really just two parameters and two unknowns, and from that you can unfold the mass and the radius individually from each of the neutron stars that you observe through this spectral approach. But we need much higher signal-to-noise data, and the kinds of instrumentation that we need to do it actually already exist and are ready to be launched. The key is to use calorimeters, and one is going to be launched in a couple of years called Astro-H, with another one being planned. We'll see how it goes, Athena-X, in a decade or so. Calorimeters are valuable not just because they're very sensitive, but because they have high spectral resolution. So with a calorimeter, you typically get 2.5 eV spectral resolution at a keV, whereas with XMM, for example, the PN, you have something that's like 40 times greater than that. And because of that, you can more sensitively measure that second derivative at the peak of the spectrum. And the number of counts that are needed are, you know, orders of magnitude smaller than what you need. So it's possible to go to systems like a bright source that's in the field, or our sources that are in globular clusters, and actually measure the masses and the radius, constrain those mass radius uncertainties to error regions like this in amounts of time that are reasonable with the kinds of instruments that exist or will exist soon. Yes, they have many students and many envelopes in Russia. I'm sure they will be able to do that. The calculations actually, and the hydrogen atmosphere spectra are not quite as certain as we need in order to do this sort of analysis. They're almost there. So we're pushing that forward. And it's easy to do. We've published the code, so if anybody's interested in doing that, you can take our code and start doing it from there. It's a non-trivial piece of code, but it's useful sometimes to start off with somebody else's code. So that's great. So, but I'll tell you, the most valuable source to do this with is a field source. And that's because these sources and globular clusters are kiloparsecs away. A field source will be brighter and closer. And that means that because it's brighter, you can spend less time. You can do it in like 5 kiloseconds with a reasonable large area instrument, like certainly Athena X, slightly larger with Astro H. So that means that this is sort of becomes a trivial measurement. The difficulty with field sources, of course, are going to be that we don't know their distances. That's something that Gaia can potentially make a big contribution to. Depending on the V magnitude of the companion star, this would be sort of optimistically bright. But if the companion stars for some of the quiescent low maxillary binaries for field sources gets as high as 15 while Gaia observes them, then we can get 3% distances to them out to about 1.4 kiloparsecs or so. And then it's just a matter of population statistics, whether those types of field sources exist. And that's something that we're working on by studying sources that are in the Rosat-Allsky survey and trying to find other examples of them. So this remains for the future. Let me finish there. Thank you for all of your attention. But what we've done is we've measured the radius of a neutron star to about 15% accuracy, 90% confidence, in a model-dependent way, meaning that we've made certain assumptions. There's a lot of significant work that's done that needs to be done in order to confirm many of the assumptions behind this approach. But it's astrophysically well justified. I'm certainly willing to talk about that if you have questions about it. And then I just leave you with the fact that just a mere handful of simultaneous mass radius measurements, assuming that they are along different masses of neutron stars, we don't want them to all have the exact same mass radius, that's sort of less useful. But if you have 5 or 7 of them, then that should implicate a very specific equation of state, and that'd be a very useful constraint for our nuclear physicist friends. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, we've bombarded Bob with questions, and I'm still surprised that you're standing on your feet since you started driving at 8 a.m. But any other questions?
So for the equation state actually lying within your area, can you remind me what the physics they actually correspond to is?
So WFF1 is sort of the favored one by this approach. And I really couldn't tell you what the physics is behind that one, other than it's an old one, it's considered a standard one, and less exotic than the ones that predict larger radii. So it's one of the older equations of state. That's the best I can do, I'm sorry.
They
have differences in their calculational approaches. They have differences in their phenomenology, what the basic physics are behind them. And so there's.
So they'll all sort of take some simplified limit of QCD, calculate their extrapolation.
No, not even that. So GM3
is
one that I'm familiar with. So this is an effective field theory that maps onto the right properties of the physics. Nothing quite as close to evolution.
I know it's a magnitude.
You told me to hold it to the end. You talked a little bit about measuring redshift and stuff.
Right.
So what happens if they're rotating at breakup? You could get surface velocities that are 50% the speed of light.
Yes.
And not have big redshifts and blue shifts.
Yes.
And that means you don't see one black body. You see a combination of them. And it's not going to shift. It's going to change the shape. It's going to make it broad.
So the way that I would address that is I would start here and say the level of uncertainty in our measured radius is much, much larger than would be produced unless they're all spinning at near breakup. So it's going to be a small effect for what we have here, given the level of uncertainty. And there are other systematic effects that we can explore before that one. The most important being that they're all hydrogen atmosphere low mass X-ray binaries. Well, it's not a...
Yeah, 10% effect would be a 5% effect in the temperature, right? And so that's...
So that's it broadening, as you described, but it's not a shift.
The real question is, what would the atmospheric modeling codes do if they saw something that was intrinsically broader than the thought it wasn't?
The likely interpretation is that it's due to redshift, because it's broader than it should be. So it would change the interpretation of the redshift, so it would change the interpretation of the masses of the neutron stars first. That would be the major effect. But I agree that it's not negligible and it has been neglected. Let me show you, hold on. I'd like to show this, where is it? It's here someplace, is that it? Nope. Here we go. That's not what I want. So these are some of the implicit assumptions in this analysis. First of all, that they're hydrogen atmosphere neutron stars. Second of all, that they have low magnetic fields, which observationally there's no evidence for them. If they did, actually, we would exclude them from the systems. But they haven't been observed in outbursts, and that's where you most expect to see the magnetic field, not when they're quiescent. So it is a question. That they're emitting isotropically, which there are very strong theoretical reasons to believe, and that they're non-rotating. And this is what I tell my theorist friends. Okay? These are assumptions in this analysis. There's good astronomical reasons to believe that they're true, but if you don't like them, you can say we find the assumptions not strongly supported and therefore ignore this result. You can do that. That's totally reasonable. But if you ask any astronomer if these are reasonable assumptions, they'll tell you yes. I certainly will. Go ahead.
Can you remove at least some of those assumptions, like the non-rotating while we change the
other? Say that again?
Can you remove, for instance, the non-rotating assumptions?
So what you would have to do is, first of all, we need a good calculation for what the emergent spectrum is for a neutron star, which has also in implication, the uncertainty in its aspect angle. So are you looking at it face down at the rotation axis or face up? So there's two major uncertain points there. And there's no way of detecting that unless the sources are an outburst, and the sources in globular clusters have never been observed in outburst. None of the ones that are on this list anyway. And the reason they were chosen is because they're in low absorption globular clusters. So not because they happen to have never been an outburst, but because they are observationally useful. If you have a lot of absorption, it's harder to measure the low temperature part of the spectrum. So the way to eliminate it is to detect the rotation rate and include that in the model. That's the way to do it. But there's no observational way to do that presently. So that hasn't been done. I don't think that they're going to be, I don't think the signal to noise is high enough to place a reasonable constraint on that. The uncertainty in the radiation radii are typically 15% to 5% in the best cases. And that's the radiation radius. So that's a mass radius relationship. It would certainly place a constraint on the rotation period, the rotation rate, and again, calculation for what the emergent spectrum should look like as a function of rotation rate hasn't been done, but I would still be surprised if that were significant enough to be able to tell the difference between the two, which isn't answering your question. It's just that it hasn't been done.
But if they had strong magnetic fields and if they were rotating, then you would expect them to be pulsating.
Which is another way of saying they're not isotropic. So now you have a thermal inhomogeneity on the surface, and that would mean that none of the useful assumptions in this analysis are valid. So you can't, you're not measuring the radius of the source anymore if you're getting most of the emission from a hot spot, you know, located on the, you know, the side of the neutron star that you see half the time. So that means the system is not observationally useful for this analysis.
No, but I'm just saying that the fact that you're in these systems are not pulsars.
Say that again?
The fact that these systems are not pulsating just tells you that they probably don't have a high magnetic field. They're not rotating.
Well, I would, yeah, I would say, so you shouldn't.
Well, they could be rotating, but they don't have a high magnetic field.
Right. They haven't been detected as pulsars, which is different from saying they're not pulsars. The observations of these sources have been at low X-ray luminosity, which means that there's not a lot of flux. So for example, most of them have like 2,000, 3,000 counts. We do search for pulsations from them using XMM, but the limit in the time resolution is about 3 milliseconds. So in principle, it could be faster. With 2,000 counts, the limits on the pulse fractions for a sinusoidal variation are like 20%, so it's not strongly constraining. So there is a lot of wiggle room there that a pulse could fit into. So I would consider it to be a bold assumption that it is non-existent, but it is something which is consistent with what we know about the rest of the sources. So for example, Aquila X1 has had its pulse fraction limited, measured, and limits placed on it as it fades into quiescence. And at the quiescent level, it's at less than 3%. At the 3% RMS at the known pulse period from its outburst pulse period. So Aquila X1 is an example of a QLMXB which shows no evidence of thermal inhomogeneity and quiescence. One can do the following, and that is that even if one system shows a thermal inhomogeneity at the surface, it means that system is not useful for this analysis. It makes one concerned that the entire class will have that behavior, but when the first such system would be discovered, it would be excluded from further analyses, and that would motivate deep observations of the rest to see if similar pulsations occurred. If they did, then the class obviously isn't useful for this analysis anymore, and probably this approach would disappear. But no one's, you know, there's no prediction for it. You can't expect it to happen. So for now, we move forward and improve our observations. This is probably, yeah, I mean, oh, that's not in the low-mass X-ray binary? Yeah, the funny thing about that.
Because you need the companion to update the hypercharge.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, well, yeah, no. I mean, if you have the companion, it throws a lot of hydrogen onto the surface really immediately. But let's say that you have a neutron star like Arcturus 1856, which is wandering around the galaxy by itself, nice and isolated, you know, 120 parsecs or so away. It moves with a velocity that's like 100 kilometers a second or so, and there's all this hydrogen sitting around the galaxy. So it should accrete it. Right, you can work out the time scale. You know, you can work out the time scale that it should accrete a hydrogen photosphere using the simple-minded approach. And if you do that, it works out to be about a month. So the system is maybe 500,000 years old, and it should have had enough hydrogen to accrete onto the surface to produce a hydrogen atmosphere in about a month. It's known to be magnetized, or at least thermally inhomogeneous, because a pulsation has been detected from that system. But it's like a I think it's 3% RMS variability, so it's really low. The spin period is a few seconds, so that implies to observers, though it's not proof, that it is highly magnetized systems, because that's similar to the highly magnetized systems, and also its relative use implies that. But the funny thing is that if you fit the spectrum of that source with a hydrogen atmosphere spectrum, the radius that you get for it is like 200 kilometers. So, here's the thing, though. That can't be excluded, right? I mean, if you look at the equations of state, if you had like a really low, you could have a really low mass neutron star with an enormous radius, but it's not taken seriously. No. It goes in the other direction. It's the other direction that it goes. Look, where is that? Get that, here we go. That one there. So here, what happens is that if you get to a really low mass neutron star, the radius blows up.
They really shouldn't have any rotation, otherwise they wouldn't
stay. Yeah, that's true. It's a few seconds. That's a good question. Oh, I've never worked that out. That's a really good point. It's rotating at a few seconds, so probably a couple hundred kilometers is probably getting problematic there. Yeah, I haven't worked that out. What's the Keplerian speed for a?
So
it's,
we assume m is the same, so a couple hundred.
Versus tens, that's tens.
So 30 times.
Mm-hmm.
So the breakup would be 30 times
milliseconds. Milliseconds. So it's too big for a breakup there. You should write an apt letter on that. Get out this morning.
Okay, with the picture, I mean, it doesn't break up. Didn't we say the period is 1 second?
So the period is a few seconds. And the implication is that if it were spinning with the period that's observed from it, it should be broken up if it's a hydrogen atmosphere neutron star.
No.
Oh,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes. Oh, well, okay. So then it could be one.
If you can accumulate a hydrogen atmosphere in a month, what can it do in a million years? I mean,
it has a thicker hydrogen atmosphere.
Thick hydrogen
ball? There's another prediction. There's a mechanism that was pointed out that you have gamma burning. So the hydrogen will tunnel deeper into the neutron star. And if you stopped accretion, it should burn. So a photospheric thickness of, half a centimeter, 10 to the 6 grams per cubic per square centimeter of hydrogen should burn off in about 100 years. So that's the time scale. Yeah, so there's no, this is the important consideration that this is cold matter. So it's non-relativistic. And there are no other systems in the universe known that have cold, bulk, dense nuclear matter, with the exception of nuclei themselves.
So knowing the equation of state in this case, in the cold case, you're not going to make it easier to extrapolate to the other.
The way that I would put it is that it is a system which has to be consistent with theory which has no other application. It's its own parameter space. It should be the easiest parameter space, I think. Right? It's like the kinetic theory of gases. You get the pressures function, you get the equation of state from the kinetic theory of gases. How come there's no comparable mathematical approach for dense matter? Should be that easy, right?
Okay, with that. So Bob is visiting till
tomorrow
afternoon.
Yeah.
And so if he'll be around, but we're now going to try to see if we can get some food before he
Okay. Am I looking faint? Thank you very much for your attention.